This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. For better or for worse, I'm not sure there's a person living who hasn't had some exposure to AA, to the concept of AA, to the existence of AA. The 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous has actually been a long-standing and trusted method of drug and alcohol recovery for more than 75 years, and yet the debate goes on about the validity of its success. Many outspoken critics argue that there is no actual data or scientific evidence to support the claims that the program works. Dedicated 12-steppers, on the other hand, stand by the familiar slogan, "If it works, if you work it," meaning if you follow the steps, you will indeed find the path to recovery. To set the record straight, we are joined today by internationally recognized clinical psychologist, Dr. Joseph Nowinski. Dr. Joseph Nowinski, welcome to Mind Talk.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Now, Dr. Nowinski, you have written a book entitled If You Work It, It Works. And in fact, you just heard me describe that as sort of the mantra for AA 12-steppers, if you will. The subtitle of your book is interesting because it is subtitled The Science Behind the 12-Step Recovery. The science behind the 12-step recovery. For many years and for many people, actually, there has been no science. It was sort of this feel good. If you went to a group, it would all be okay. And if you didn't, it might not be okay. But you're saying that there is actual science to suggest that the 12-step program can be a quite successful program.
That's correct. I think the critics, there are lots of critics out there, as you know, many of whom, unfortunately, are people who just had a personal bad experience, and that can happen in any self-help group, you know, had a personal bad experience with a sponsor or some such thing, and they're angry, and then they conclude that AA as a whole doesn't work. There are other skeptics out there who either are not aware of the science or are aware of it but choose to ignore it. As you said, AA has been around a while. And the truth be told, prior to, say, around 1990, there was very little science, you know, very little clinical trials, rigorous research to investigate it, other than for AA's triennial member surveys, which it has done since 1977. Hmm. But a lot of people didn't consider that to be hard science.
Right.
But in 1989, a prestigious institution called the Institute of Medicine issued a white paper saying that AA was, as you said, one of the most widely used resources for recovery from alcohol and drug abuse, but it really had not been rigorously researched, and they called for that to happen. And one of the good things that resulted from that white paper was that subsequently, in the last 20 years or so since then, there have been, that was the green light for organizations such as the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism and so forth, to fund academically based studies.
Okay.
And so there have been now a lot of those studies have accumulated. It takes a long time to do some of those studies, and some of them are 16-year studies, 7-year studies, 8-year studies that are only recently published. Also, the fact is that those studies are always published in peer-reviewed academic journals.
Right.
And the general public doesn't even have access to those without paid subscriptions. And moreover, even if you had access, to be honest with you, if you don't have a lot of experience in research, it's hard for the average person to
exactly
interpret that.
It can be a hard read.
Yeah, if you try try to read an academic journal, it's a hard read even for me. And I've been doing this for some 25, 30 years. But, you know, but you can do it if you've got, you've got the experience doing it. But the purpose of writing the book was to take that research and that's been buried in these academic journals all these years and to translate it into language that a non-researcher can understand. And lay it out there as to what that research really has to say about the 12-step model of recovery.
When we talk about the 12-step model of recovery, there is a glaring, if you will, assumption that if you are not religious, this is not going to work. And that if you are religious, you might stand, if you'll pardon me, a prayer. So let's talk a little bit about that basic concept before we actually go into the various kinds of research.
I mean, I think that's true. And I think when I started doing this research quite a few years ago, even the researchers that invited me in to do some of this research to develop 12-step oriented interventions were of the opinion that AA was a religion. It's not a religion. It does mention the word God, but specifically says God as we understand him. And that was inserted because Bill Wilson himself, one of the co-founders of AA, was a lifelong agnostic. He was not religious. He was an agnostic.
Okay.
And so AA is not a religious organization. It is a spiritual, there's been some research on this too we can talk about later. It's a spiritual organization to the extent that it advocates certain spiritual values such as altruism, humility, reaching out to others, giving back, honesty, the value of honesty. So it does espouse certain values that would be called spiritual, but there's no religious organization to it. But just like any other group, any other self-help group, there are a great diversity of people who go to AA.
Right.
Some of whom are very religious. And so you may find a meeting because there's no centralization of AA. There's all kinds of meetings.
Right.
And you may indeed find meetings where they may be Christian. There may be their Orthodox Jewish AA meetings. But there are plenty of meetings that have absolutely no religious, if you will, bias or flavor to them at all.
So you really can pick and choose, and you're not required to participate in any particular religious pursuit. You talk early on in your book, which again is entitled "If You Work It, It Works." You talk about Project Match. What's Project Match?
Well, Project Match was basically how I got into the research into 12-step the 12-step model. I had published a book on adolescent substance abuse based on a 12-step model, and that book ended up being circulated among some colleagues. So I was invited to develop a 12-step oriented intervention for something called Project Match, which was the largest psychotherapy study ever conducted. It was conducted over 7 years.
Mm.
There were 9 treatment sites nationally involved in it. Many of the major alcohol researchers in the country participated in it. And so what they did is they wanted to compare 3 different kinds of treatment approaches. One is called cognitive behavioral treatment, which is very popular still. Another was motivational enhancement therapy, which was sort of in its developing stage then and has become popular. And the third one was my intervention, which was called 12-step facilitation. So they each had different theories to them. Cognitive behavioral intervention was based on the idea that if you teach coping skills to people with alcohol or drug problems, that's what they need. The motivational approach was designed to help them, people, move them toward a decision to do something about an alcohol or drug problem.
Okay.
And of course, my program was designed to help them to facilitate their involvement in a 12-step recovery fellowship as a means of dealing with their alcohol problem.
So it sounds like actually the 3 approaches, if combined, could be really quite something.
Well, actually, as 12-step facilitation is practiced now in the latest iterations, I mean, I've been developing it over the years. Mm-hmm. I certainly have incorporated aspects of both motivational mm-hmm. enhancement therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy because I'm a pragmatist, and so I have no problem with that. But the results of Project Match were interesting, and even some skeptics have questioned that, even though this is an incredibly well-designed study.
Well, you know, there's always somebody to question. Dr. Nowinski, I'm just going to ask you to make sure you speak directly into the phone.
Sure.
Okay, terrific.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
So skeptics have even questioned Project Match, but the truth is that what they found was that all three treatments were effective. All three treatments, the people who were randomly assigned to all three had significant reductions in drinking, increases in what they call percent days abstinent, and decreases in drinks per drinking day. So when they did drink, they drank a lot less.
Okay.
However, 12-step facilitation had about a 10% advantage over the other two, and that 10% advantage endured over 3 years.
Mm.
And also, people who were in the 12-step treatment were twice as likely to stay abstinent in the year after treatment.
With the 12-step facilitation program.
Right, right. So I have no axe to grind with cognitive behavioral or motivational enhancement therapy. Okay, I think that they should certainly be used. But I really take issue with people who say the 12-step model doesn't work because it actually was 10% more effective. And the people in that treatment were twice as likely to stay abstinent.
Well, let's talk about the 12-step facilitation therapy program. What does that mean? When folks hear that, if they participate in this approach, what will be some of the aspects of this approach?
Well, it's a treatment approach that's administered by professionals, like mm-hmm. by therapists and counselors. Some people have pointed out that 12-step facilitation is not AA. No, it isn't, because AA is something you could just walk into, okay?
Right.
You can walk into a meeting. A 12-step facilitation is a therapeutic intervention which has the same goals, though, as AA, in which the therapist tries to facilitate involvement in a 12-step fellowship, educates the patient about key concepts so that they correct any misperceptions about what you talked about before, about it being a religion or about having to you know, pay dues or having to, you know, commit to a particular religious belief. So the therapist tries to educate. The therapist coaches the patient, and, you know, some people may be shy. Some people may have social anxiety.
Sure.
They may need some help in sort of making their way into those first meetings.
Absolutely.
The therapist helps process those meeting experiences. But the overall goal is to facilitate involvement, which means going to meetings, making some friends there, getting phone numbers, getting emails, addresses, getting a sponsor. Those things that are associated with actually getting involved in a 12-step fellowship. And the research has shown that those factors, getting involved and doing those things, not just going to meetings, are highly correlated with recovery.
Okay. And you make the point, which I'd like to go over in more detail when we come back from the break, you make the point that involvement is not the same thing as attendance. So when we come back from the break, I'd like to pick up right there. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with Dr. Joseph Nowinski, author of If You Work It, It Works, the science behind 12-step recovery. We'll be right back. Folks, we return to the conversation with Dr. Joseph Nowinski. Dr. Nowinski, just before the break, I asked if you would talk to us about your comment that there is a difference between involvement in AA versus attendance at AA. What's the difference?
Well, there is. First of all, there is research that has shown that people who there's one 16-year study, by the way, which found that very important, 16 years long, that people who started treatment and going to AA at the same time had much better outcomes than those people who either went to treatment and not AA or AA without treatment. So that's something for clinicians to be aware of that. And also over the 16 years, if someone stopped going to, those people who stopped going to AA at any point were more likely to start drinking again.
Interesting.
So that's also some evidence that it's probably important to stay connected to AA. That doesn't mean you go every day, but some connection to AA. But
well, let me ask you this. For the clinicians who are interesting, who actually want to see the studies, where might they go?
Oh, it's in the book.
Okay.
It's a Moose and Moose out of Stanford University. It's Rudolph and Bernice Moose. My book discusses all of these studies, but there's an appendix which includes all the references.
Okay.
So anyone who wants to say double check on what I'm saying is free to get those look at those references.
So anyone who wants
study. But you mentioned it, go ahead.
Anyone who wants to put themselves through it can.
If they want to go through what I went through, yeah, they're welcome to jump into the deep end of the pool. But there's more research that shows that is it just going to meetings, and the answer is no, because Keith Humphreys of Stanford conducted some study, and there are others in my book, but I'll just give you this one.
Okay.
And they assessed not only going to meetings, but whether they had a sponsor, picked a sponsor, whether they made friends in AA, and whether they read recovery-oriented materials. There are other ways of getting involved, but look, those three.
Okay.
If they got a sponsor, made friends, and read material. And they found, lo and behold, that those people who scored higher in terms of involvement, had much more significantly better outcomes 2 years later than those who just went to meetings. Although going to meetings helps,
Okay.
But there was a significant advantage for those people who not only went to meetings but got involved. And the dynamic that seems to be operating there is that as people get involved, they start to identify with the fellowship. They're not just sort of on the outside looking in, but they're kind of on the inside, and they feel like they're part of the fellowship. And that seems to be very predictive of recovery.
What's interesting is your statement that at any point that folks may choose to drop out of AA, that actually could be an indicator that they will not be able to maintain recovery on their own, that going to AA continually, as you said, not necessarily every day, but that it becomes a real part of your life, is actually part of your ongoing recovery.
Right. That's correct, and it's kind of consistent with AA's membership surveys, in terms of people who have been in recovery for a long time, tending to stay connected to the fellowship. And that's, been controversial to some. There are some clinicians who argue that, after a year, you don't really need to be going to meetings anymore. The Moose study over 16 years unequivocally showed that if they stop at any point, they're more likely to drink again. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody became an alcoholic.
Right.
But it does mean that they started drinking again. And if you start out as an alcoholic and at some point you decide to drop out of AA and start drinking again, you're at risk certainly for, having an alcohol use disorder again.
I think we need to take a step back for a moment, and because we're throwing around the word recovery, and I'm wondering what your definition is of recovery. For some people, it means never drinking again. It includes never drinking again in life. And for others, it's being able to drink in mind. I mean, it just means different things to different people. So when you say recovery, what are you talking about?
Well, what I'm saying is that we need to think of the drinking world, if you will, as not existing in two categories, alcoholics and everybody else.
Okay.
We really need to think of it in terms of a spectrum. And the new diagnostic manual of the American Psychiatric Association is a breakthrough because it looks at it that way. So that we need to look at it all the way from low-risk drinking, which is defined as no more than 14 drinks a week for a man and 7 for a woman,
wow,
to what we call a mild substance use disorder, to a moderate one, to a severe one. So if you're in the mild zone, so that your drinking is causing you or your drug use some mild problems, then it may make sense to think of moderation or controlled use as a reasonable goal.
Okay.
But once you've advanced into the moderate to severe end, the research suggests that trying to moderate is not a useful goal.
Okay.
That at that point, choosing a goal of abstinence, those people who choose abstinence, who have that kind of, you know, more severe problem. Again, one study in the book looks at people who they made three choices, either total abstinence as their goal, controlled drinking as their goal, or what they call conditional abstinence, which means I'm going to stop for a while and then decide what to do.
Okay.
And they followed those people for several years. And what happened at the end of those several years, the group that chose abstinence at the beginning had the best outcome.
Interesting.
The
okay.
people who chose controlled drinking had the worst outcome.
All right.
Now, those are for the people, again, who have more than a mild problem. So moderation management or controlled drinking might work if you have a mild problem, if you have a full-time job, if you have family support. But once you kind of drift further, those people often still you know, struggle if they want to moderate. But the research suggests that at that point, choosing abstinence is probably the better choice.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. So let's talk about if there are any other predictors that you found of sobriety. Clearly what you're saying is that a real engagement in treatment to include AA, I think that's what your process is, including AA, that's a huge predictor. Are there any other things that are predictors of abstinence, of sobriety or the lack thereof?
Well, those are the most important ones,
okay.
that willingness to get involved. Identification is another predictor. One study done in England, again, asked people to identify themselves. How do you think of yourself? Do you think of yourself as an addict or a recovering addict?
Mm.
As an alcoholic or a recovering alcoholic? And that's interesting because some people have argued to me that you know, having to say you're a recovering alcoholic is stigmatizing, and why should people have to do that? But that research out of England showed that the people who identify themselves as recovering, okay, scored higher in something called self-efficacy. Which means a belief that I can change my life, I can control my life, I can do something about my life. Those people who identify themselves as recovering scored higher in self-efficacy, and self-efficacy in turn was associated with better outcome, higher abstinence rates,
okay.
lower what you call drinks per drinking day. So those people did better than the people who simply identified themselves as alcoholics.
Interesting.
And that's something about if you identify yourself as a recovering alcoholic, that tends to mean that you're involved in some kind of fellowship.
And that you are actually engaged in the process. There's something that you can do about it. Whereas
exactly.
with the first one, it kind of sounds like it's a label and it's a label. And so there it is. It's a label. And there's no place to really go with that.
Right. Right. And again, let me say that if for a therapist who may be listening, is there no reason not to do cognitive behavioral or motivational enhancement techniques. I think that MET, for example, is designed to help people make a decision to do something about their problem.
Okay.
My solution is that the thing that they should do is go to AA or NA or any fellowship that supports sobriety. It could be Women for Sobriety. It could be Smart Recovery. It could be any of these fellowships whose goal is to help people stay clean and sober,
okay.
as opposed to moderating.
Now, it's interesting that you say smart recovery. I'm not sure where they are now, but I know that at one point, smart recovery sort of presented themselves as the alternative to AA.
All these people are, AA, AA has no public relations office, so they don't, and they avoid public controversy by tradition. So people can compete with AA. I don't see it as competitive. I think that if smart recovery is a more of a cognitive behaviorally oriented treatment, kind of centered in Boston, the Boston area, but its goal, see, even though it uses cognitive behavioral, its goal is very compatible. It's a fellowship. People go to the meeting.
Right.
They're there to support each other's sobriety. The difference is that smart recovery is therapist-led,
okay.
As opposed to AA, which is a totally peer-run organization.
Okay, gotcha. The research that you did, I'm curious as to whether or not the groups were ethnically diverse, were gender diverse, were income level and educationally diverse.
Yeah, they were.
Okay.
All of the studies in the book are described, like where they came from and who they were. The results seem to be very, very similar. For example, in Project Match, the one hypothesis was that AA would work better for men for a couple of reasons. One, because it was a program developed by men. And the second hypothesis that some people said is because the word powerless, I'm powerless over alcoholism, that would somehow not work well for women. But that wasn't the way it turned out. It turned out that it was equally effective for women and men.
Okay.
And basically every study in the book suggests the same thing. Also, some of the studies, for example, are samples from the Veterans Administration, so they're veterans. Some are samples from community-based clinics where there's a whole variety of real income ranges.
Okay.
One was an interesting study that was done by Kaiser Permanente of over 1,200 of their patients.
Hmm.
Now, these were people who were, at least middle class, because they were all enrolled in an integrated healthcare system.
Right.
And so what they found was very, very strikingly similar results, that the more people were involved in a 12-step fellowship 5 years later, the better was their outcome.
Well, and I guess it makes sense that when you feel connected or committed to another human being, you also feel connected and committed to yourself in a different kind of way than if you're just
exactly.
kind of out there.
Exactly, and you're sharing a common goal.
Right. And that makes it easier. You've almost got built-in supports. We're going to take a break but when we come back, I'd like to talk more about those built-in supports with AA, the sponsors, and what that all means. And so, folks, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we will continue with Dr. Joseph Nowinski, who was talking to us about the science behind the 12-step recovery. If you work it, it works. Again, the science behind 12-step recovery. We'll be right back. Thank you. Hi, folks. We continue with the conversation with Dr. Joseph Nowinski, and I just want to remind you that there are many resources actually listed at the back of Dr. Nowinski's book, as well as the 12 steps and the 12 traditions for those of you who might be interested in doing further research. Dr. Nowinski, sponsors. Why are sponsors so important? Are they important? And I ask that from the perspective of, we've already talked about the value of sort of really connecting to another person, but how is connecting to another person in AA different, if it is different, from identifying a sponsor?
Well, I think that, you know, again, we talk about the difference between going to meetings and getting involved. There are people who certainly, I've you know, been involved in this research for a long time and listened to plenty of therapy tapes and so forth and seen people who go to meetings, but they don't participate. And, you know, their chances of recovery are, you know, are much less because they're, again, standing on the outside looking in. They may be sitting there, but they're not getting involved. When you choose a sponsor, you're getting involved. You're now establishing a relationship. You're now sort of identifying with somebody else in the program who has a common goal with you. You see, there's a very big difference.
Okay.
Sponsors, you know, AA is not centralized. They say AA is interesting. It's sort of like a lot of cultures where all the traditions and rituals are handed down by sort of like oral history, you know. And within AA, the sponsor is the vehicle for that.
Okay.
Sponsors are how AA exists and passes down its traditions and rituals and culture from person to person. It doesn't come from any central office.
I see.
So, because it is so decentralized, there's no training program, no credentials required for being a sponsor. A sponsor is someone who ideally has some recovery under their belt. Has sort of walked the walk, if you will, for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Is generally of the same sexual orientation as a sponsee, and it's going to be their guide. And people can switch sponsors along the way,
okay.
But it's sort of a guide. So it's a way of sort of connecting instead of just sitting on the outside. Now, one study in the book looked at people who got a sponsor and stayed intensively involved with a sponsor over a period of years, okay?
Okay.
Versus people who who didn't get a sponsor or were minimally involved with a sponsor, okay? And they measured that by how often do you talk or email to your sponsor, how often do you meet with your sponsor.
Okay.
And after like 5 years, the people who were intensively involved with a sponsor were 7 times more likely to be abstinent than the other group.
That's interesting.
So if you think about it, is it important to get a sponsor, I say to people, yes, it is important. And as a therapist, I recognize that some people are shy.
Yes.
And so that's, you know, if you walk into an AA meeting and you raise your hand, you say, I need a sponsor, someone will respond to you. But, you know, the shy person sometimes benefits from some counseling. Or counsel will say, well, let's role play it.
Okay.
Know?
Gotcha.
Imagine, you know, that you're walking in, and how would you ask for a sponsor? What should you look for in a sponsor? You know, how to shop around, if you will. You know, go to meetings and look around and listen to people until you sort of, you know, spy one or two that you really kind of like, and maybe those would be, you know, good sponsors. But the research shows a sevenfold advantage for people who stay in touch with a sponsor over time.
With a sponsor. So the recommendation is that you have one sponsor at a time or two or three?
No, one at a time. And mostly, very often people switch sponsors at some point. They might ask for a temporary sponsor. So that someone might say, I'll be your temporary sponsor for the next year.
Okay.
Okay. Because sponsors can, you know, it's all voluntary. They,
right.
They may not want to commit themselves to more than that. So also someone may decide that after a year they, you know, would like to pick another sponsor. That's all pretty common practice within any 12-step fellowship.
Okay. Is it reasonable to think that after one has been in AA for a while, you've got a relationship with your sponsor, maybe you don't need therapy anymore. Maybe your sponsor can take the place of your therapist.
Well, sponsors are not therapists. They are, you know, they're knowledgeable about 12-step recovery. They have a lot of, there's a lot of shared wisdom that comes through the 12-step fellowship. You know, things like people place, avoiding slippery people, slippery places, slippery things. You know, sponsors are wise and share that kind of knowledge. But people, you know, may have other real issues. They may have issues of depression, anxiety, sure. PTSD. I think it'd be very important to not neglect those you know, concurrent issues.
Okay.
There's some good research, by the way, that shows that again, 12-step facilitation or getting involved with 12-step fellowship has some beneficial effects on depression, anxiety, and mm-hmm. even PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a cure for it, but it's beneficial. So that points us in the direction that if you tackle both issues at once, you know, your substance abuse issue plus your psychiatric issue, you're going to be much better off.
All right, so then from your perspective, the person who's in AA and has a sponsor could or should reasonably have a therapist as well?
Absolutely.
Okay.
With a proviso that therapist, you know, can't be anti-AA. It's
well,
not going to help you go to a therapist who says they don't believe in AA or it's a cult or something like that. So
well, but you
it
know,
has to be someone who's comfortable with it.
You really bring up an interesting point, because there are certainly some therapists who will say, you don't need AA. You just need to come to me. Or,
right.
you know, you've been going for 10 years, you're using it as a crutch.
Right.
or any number of things. So for somebody who was in AA and has a sponsor and they see that AA is working for them, is it reasonable to say that your recommendation would be not to leave AA but to leave the therapist and find someone who's supportive of AA?
Well, I certainly would question a therapist. You know, again, that therapist may not be informed. The idea that you're here, you've been sober, clean sober for 5 years, so you don't need AA. But that study I mentioned before, well, if you stop going, you're going to be at risk for slipping.
Okay.
So therapists need to maybe be more informed about this, about the importance of having it. But there should be no competition, in my mind,
gotcha.
Between a therapist and somebody's involvement in a 12-step fellowship. Or if it's a woman, there should be no conflict between her going to Women for Sobriety and having a therapist.
Okay.
There's no reason for any sort of conflict or competition between the two.
Gotcha. You make the point about there being a significant difference between a typical referral to AA, which is essentially, here's the phone number, go, and
right.
an intensive referral, which is much more than that. How are the two different? What is an intensive referral versus a typical referral?
Well, 12-step facilitation would be called an intensive referral.
Okay.
The whole goal of it is to get someone involved in a fellowship. So that's what the therapist is doing in 12-step facilitation. They're not just giving them, mentioning it. When I started doing this about 20 years ago, I would talk to colleagues, and they would say, oh, I'm in favor of AA. And I said, well, what do you do? Well, I you know, I give them a meeting schedule, or I suggest that they go to AA. And then I said, well, what happens then? And they say, well, if they don't like it, that's it, you know. So intensive referral, there is a study in the book about intensive referral
okay.
where the patients would come in to therapy, and in the first session, the therapist would not only explain more about 12-step fellowships, but there'd be a member of AA or NA in the room, a volunteer, there to help explain the program, answer questions, and offer to go to a couple of meetings with that patient.
Interesting.
So you see, it's a much more, as the word says, much more intensive than just a therapist saying, well, maybe you should try AA.
Right. Okay. The Oxford House program. Folks on the outside, I'm not sure that they know a lot about the beginnings of the Oxford House program and what is intended to provide and how it intersects with AA. So can you talk about that?
Well, I haven't been inside Oxford House, but I know about it. I know that the Oxford movement, of course, was, you know, what influenced, you know, Bill Wilson, its emphasis on honesty, you know, being able to own up to, you know, your personal faults and flaws. And of course, he argued that one of the root causes of addiction, alcoholism, is kind of an inflated ego. And I think that remains true, because that can be a major obstacle for persons going into their first AA meeting to kind of say, well, I can't do this myself. I have to reach out to others. Mm-hmm. But the Oxford House program immerses people. There's a study in the book about it. The difference is that it immerses its members in the fellowship. Okay, they have meetings, they read materials, they have groups that talk about that sort of parallel AA meetings. So it's a much more immersive experience. From what I understand, it's not kind of religious per se, so much as it's immersed in the AA model. And again, the study that's in my book showed that people who, you know, went from inpatient treatment to an Oxford House program, as opposed to an outpatient treatment where the therapist didn't necessarily emphasize, you know, a 12-step fellowship, they had a much better outcome again by seemingly the benefits of sort of, again, sort of that social support you mentioned before. That's a key to the whole thing, you know, that social network support.
Now, with Oxford House, folks can actually live there.
Yeah.
In living there, are you saying that they have meetings there, AA-like
exactly.
meetings there, and they would still go to their other AA meetings, or how does that work?
Well, they may have a job, they may do any number of things. So, but while there's readings, that there's sort of like a culture, if you will, or a group commitment to 12-step recovery, and that's, you know, and that was again compared to people who went from inpatient to a standard outpatient treatment program, where the therapists weren't necessarily focusing, again, to that extent on the 12-step fellowship involvement. It's that network support that is one of the keys to recovery, that the ability to move from, again, studies related to Project Match, and that showed that people whose social networks tended to support drinking, you know, whose mm-hmm. friends and family
right.
tended to be drinkers, you know, they fared much worse than those who either social networks didn't support drinking or who went to AA. So the idea is that, again, AA is where you can develop a network of friends who are going to support recovery, as opposed to, let's face it, a lot of people who have substance use disorders, their social network doesn't necessarily support sobriety. And if they have a mental illness, it doesn't necessarily support treatment for their mental illness.
Exactly. Exactly so. Dr. Nowinski, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue, and we'll be talking about MAZE. I believe that's the way it's pronounced, Making Nowinski? Alcoholics
yeah.
Anonymous Easier. Folks, we'll be right back.
Yeah.
Hi, folks. This is Pamela Brewer. We're continuing with Dr. Joseph Nowinski. Dr. Nowinski, before we start talking about making Alcoholics Anonymous easier, we've been talking about adults. And I wonder what kinds of studies, if any, have been done about the treatment for adolescent alcoholics.
Well, yeah, I got into this whole thing by starting a program and writing a book about adolescent substance abuse.
Yes.
And I consulted at a place in Grand Rapids for 5 or 6 years, a few years ago, to develop one. But first of all, let me say that some people would say that, well, you know, the 12 steps aren't appropriate for adolescents. In my experience, that's not true at all.
Mm.
That if you ask a teenager to talk about spirituality, even the concept of God, they're quite willing to talk about that.
Okay.
They are, you know, quite willing to, if you get through their denial, to acknowledge that drugs and alcohol making their lives totally unmanageable. Of course, they initially try to deny it.
Right.
So the 12-step approach is very conducive. They take to it very well. The problem with adolescent treatment is the relapse rate, because adolescents, by and large, tend to go back to the same peer group they were in before they get treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one predictor of relapse for adolescents is peer pressure.
Okay.
So if 12-step treatment or any treatment for adolescents can work, but just like, you know, with adults where you're trying to steer them toward a supportive network, with adolescents it's vital. It's vital to steer them away from the drug culture, if you will. And the relapse rates have been phenomenally high in adolescent substance abuse treatment, almost exclusively due to that factor. So that's a problem, but it's something that needs to be addressed. What we did in our Michigan program is that after people, the adolescents left the treatment program itself, they migrated into a recovery classroom in a local high school. And the local high school agreed to sponsor that recovery classroom, where the kids who graduated would meet for breakfast in the morning and then go to classes and then meet for lunch and go to classes and then have an after-school activity.
Okay.
And the success rate was much higher.
Interesting.
Because they tended to orient themselves toward their peers rather than their old friends.
There, I'm going to ask you a question that's a little bit askew from your most recent work that we're discussing in the book, but just sticking with the adolescent population for a moment.
Yep.
Is there a way for parents to have a reasonable sense that their child might in fact be drinking? Are there some things that they can look for? I would suggest that parents would typically deny the fact that an adolescent is drinking who wants to think about their child as being an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. But are there ways, are there behaviors that a parent can look at and at least say, well, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. One is school performance.
Okay.
Declining school performance. And the adolescent, I'm going to say, but blame that on the school or the teachers, but declining school performance is almost always associated with substance abuse.
Okay.
I'm not talking about occasional pot smoking in adolescence, okay? But I'm talking about the kid who's really getting involved, as they say, and as some of them describe to me, using anything they can get their hands on and getting high as often as they can. They can't maintain their academic performance, so that's number one. Number two, changing peer groups. You'll notice that what happened to, you know, you'll talk to your daughter and say, what happened to your old friend Sally? Well, I don't hang out with her so much anymore. She hasn't been calling. They start drifting toward a more substance-using peer group, okay? That network support issue is number two. Changes in the way they appear, the clothing that they choose to wear, and emotional changes. Because what happens is, you know, the adolescent who's getting high a lot, they're going to be coming down from that. And you're going to notice that your adolescent, well, adolescents are moody, but you're going to notice that there's a much more intense moodiness, a tendency to be snappy a lot, to be angry, or to be isolating and depressed. So, you know, parents who see those symptoms are wise to, let's say, we're going to go see the pediatrician. And when you go to the pediatrician takes a urine sample.
Okay. And for those
That's
parents,
the best way.
For those parents who have young children, I don't know, maybe the child's 5 or 8 or 10, who could easily think that can't be what's going on with my child. My child's too young. What do you say to that?
Well, a lot of these kids start at age 10. So, thank God most schools now have developed, pretty nice, alcohol drug prevention program.
Mm-hmm.
And, including sort of refusal skills, how to say no. I think that's helpful. But, a lot of these kids will say they started drinking or using at 9 or 10. So, I think, of course, most parents would never want to think that of their
right.
child. But you got to look at these outside behaviors. School performance, changes in school performance, changes in peer group, changes in appearance, becoming very irritable, depressed, isolative. That's a reason for concern. It's either a mental illness or it's a substance use problem.
Okay.
And so I'd say, you take your kid to the doctor. They may not like that, but when you get to the doctor, and I even tell parents, look, if you have the line, just say you got to go for your annual physical. When you get there, the doctor says, I need a urine sample.
Okay.
That's your parental prerogative and your parental responsibility to intervene if you have to.
All right, so you would specifically advise parents to ask the doctor to ask for to get a urine sample.
Yep, ahead of time.
Okay.
And say, if we're going, I'm bringing Johnny in for his annual physical. They may anyway take a urine sample, but this is the behavior I've been noticing. This is what I'm worried about. Pediatricians are pretty clued into that today.
Okay.
And so they'll say, sure, we'll take a urine sample, and we're not only going to, test for blood levels or a blood test, but we're also going to test for drugs.
Okay. All right. And as you say, I know it's scary for parents, but if that's what's going on, there's no time like the present to try to figure out how to address it.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be much scarier if you ignore it.
Exactly. Indeed. All right. Let's go to, is it MAYS, Making Alcoholics Anonymous Easier? What is that?
Right. That's a program similar to Also Facilitation. It was developed by Leanne Cascutis at the Alcohol Research Group in Palo Alto. And it is basically a similar goals to 12-step facilitation, in which the therapist aims to get the participants or the patients involved in a 12-step fellowship, whether it's AA or NA. It's an interesting intervention because what MAYS, MAYSE, uses is graduates. So what they do is that some of the people who finish the program volunteer to come into the early sessions, okay, for the new people. And they explain to the new people what their experience was like in MAYSE and what their experience was like to go to AA or NA. And it's a kind of a nice way of, again, helping to facilitate people going to those first meetings.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always feasible for a therapist to do that, but in MAYSE, it was shown to be effective. They had an interesting design very quickly called on-off design, and they compared one group who went through 16 weeks of treatment to another group who went through 4 weeks of treatment, 8 weeks of MAYSE, and then 4 weeks of regular treatment. So they had, 16 and 16, but the other group had 8 weeks of MAYSE.
Okay.
And the group that had the MAYSE did much better. They did much better in terms of outcome, again, in terms of sobriety.
So it sounds like we just can't get away from the power of a support group.
No, that's the key. And that some work done in my alma mater, University of Connecticut, tried to look at what they call the network support project. And one of the things they looked at was having people try to just, instead of going to AA, see if they could just, add some non-drinkers to the social network. And what they found was that it did help, but not nearly as much as going to a 12-step fellowship. So adding, one or two, what people tended to do, by the way, is they didn't drop their old drinking friends. They just added one non-drinking friend
okay.
to the social network. So it helped a little bit, but there was about a tenfold, advantage for people who were going to getting their support through AA.
On some levels, it's amazing, and on some levels, it makes perfect human sense that the people you affiliate would have a great deal of impact on your own behavior.
Exactly. And, you know, we're all you know, influenced by those we're connected to. And I think, again, once a person goes beyond that mild, we talked about that mild, you know,
sure,
alcohol or drug use, into the moderate to severe range, they're much more likely to experience periodic cravings. They're much more likely to have developed a lifestyle that's built more around drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much easier for those people if they're hanging around, with people who tend to drink more. It's going to be much harder for them, as opposed to making friends who have the same shared goal of saying, and by the way,
mm-hmm,
a lot of people have a misconception that, boy, AA must be pretty boring. It isn't. If you go to some of the conventions, and especially some of the young people's conventions, these people are having a good time, but they're having a good time sober.
Right, which actually makes it a better time.
Yeah.
Dr. Nowinski, you have just given us so much to think about, so much wonderful information. Again, Dr. Joseph Nowinski, author of If You Work It, It Works, The Science Behind 12-Step Recovery. And again, not only does Dr. Nowinski, as he said, describe the science in very readable terms, but there are also references that you can go and actually read the studies that he references. If that's what you need to do to yourself, there's a way to do it. Dr. Nowinski, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
Same here. Dr. Nowinski, do you have any research projects coming up?
Well, actually, hopefully, I keep my fingers crossed, double-crossed, that a grant that Johns Hopkins, I'm on with Johns Hopkins Medical School, to extend 12-step facilitation to heroin users.
Ah.
So, big problem today. So keeping my fingers double-crossed that grant comes through, and we'll see how it works.
Well, I will double cross my fingers as well. And if that comes through, we would definitely like to know what the findings are.
Yep, I'll let you know.
Alrighty, terrific. Folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. Again, the author's last name for today is Nowinski, Nowinski, first name Joseph. Thank you again. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.ORG. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26x2 Productions. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. Of course, for more information about Mind Talk, you can go to mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.